Hello everyone. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome you here this evening to our heart lecture. And I wanted just to say a little bit about HLA heart before I hand over to Professor Ruth Chang. Herbert Lionel Adolphus Hart was Professor of Jurisprudence at University College here between 1952 and 1969. And a fellow here until 1973. And he was then principal, my equivalent, at Brasenose College from 1973 to 1978. Born in Harrogate in 1907, Hart practiced as a barrister at the Chancery Bar in the 1930s, then saw wartime service with MI5 and then Bletchley Park. Just imagine how interesting those conversations would have been. Rather than return to practice after the war, he accepted a teaching fellowship at New College, during which he established his reputation as a teacher and scholar. Perhaps best known for the hugely influential work he wrote whilst at uni, The Concept of Law, he is considered one of the world's foremost legal philosophers of the 20th century. His many wide-ranging publications sit at the nexus of law, philosophy and politics. The HLA Hart Visiting Fellowship was established at University College in 2005 in memory of Herbert. In the decade following 2005, some 40 distinguished scholars were awarded the fellowship and enriched the intellectual life here in college, and also, of course, the intellectual life with our faculty, with erudition and scholarly engagement. The fellowship lapsed for a short period for want of funding, but has recently been reinvigorated by a very, very generous benefaction for which we are hugely grateful. Professor Relton is the first holder of the newly relaunched HLA Hart Visiting Fellowship, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Relton to you. I would also like to thank Ray Thelman, whose generosity made this year's Hart Visiting Fellow possible. Can I also welcome Charlie Hart, Adam Hart, and his wife Frances Hollis? We're absolutely delighted to maintain the connection through you to Professor Hart and the college. I'd now like to hand over to Professor Chang, our own distinguished Professor of Jurisprudence, and professorial fellow here at UNI, who will introduce Professor Sally Haslanger, who will speak to us tonight on social justice, culture, and law.
Her heart lecture today will be about complex social systems and the structures within them, and in particular, how such structures maintain and reproduce themselves and snare us in their web, like hapless bits of insect food in a spider's web. So even when a social structure, as the skeleton of a complex social system of which law is often a part, even when that's unjust, and we know it to be unjust, and we wish it weren't unjust, we are stuck in it. Because, as various philosophers of science have argued, and Sally will elaborate, complex systems, like societies, are stable and self-sustaining because of feedback loops that allow them to adjust to any perturbation. In today's lecture, Sally will give us not only a better understanding of how and why we are stuck, but crucially, what we can do to become unstuck. As it turns out, law can only do so much. I can't think of a more important and timely set of issues for us, and we have Sally to thank for providing us with much needed illumination. Thank you.
Thank you, Valerie. Thank you, Ruth. And thank you all for coming. It is a tremendous honor to be here, the Hart Lecture. I mean, who would have ever thought? That's how I feel, a little overwhelmed. Also note, I'm speaking to you as an American, and I've been told many times that my perspective on many of these issues is distinctively American because I am an activist at heart, and I'm all about social activism. And people, I've actually had someone say to me after a talk, "Well, we don't have social movements in Britain." And I'm like, "What? You don't have the feminist movement? The women's movement? You don't what? What?" Anyway, so I realize that it may be somewhat extreme for certain and sort of culturally specific, but I hope still it speaks to you in some way. Also, I don't do legal theory. I barely do philosophy. Anyway, I do social theory, and social theory is a very interdisciplinary project. I draw heavily on critical race theory, feminist theory, and other areas in sociology, anthropology, and history. And so what I'm trying to do today is bring together some of these things in a way that I hope teaches us something about law. But you all know law like way better than I do. And so, and you know, like, I'm, again, an American, and so what I really know more about is the American legal system. So I really need to learn from you as well, and give me a sense of whether I'm way off course, because I may well be. Okay, so let's get started. Here's my outline, so this is also, I should confess, this is the first time I've ever given both a PowerPoint and a handout, so I'm going to be juggling a bit, but I needed to have some pictures because I'm a visual thinker and I think the pictures can be very helpful. So I'm going to go back and forth and I'll try to just prime you when I'm talking from the text and when I'm talking from the screen. Okay, so on the text, introduction, and then I'm going to talk about social reproduction. And I'll have three parts, structures or skeletons of systems, as we've previewed. Social relations are established and maintained in social practices. I'll then talk about social stability. All of that is about how social reproduction works. Then I'll try to talk a little bit about social change and how it seems to me the law fits into it, and talk about law and social practices and law and social meanings. And then I'll talk about some of the limitations of law alone and really bringing about social justice, and we'll draw a conclusion. Okay, so now introduction on the handout. Societies are complex systems or clusters of interacting systems that reproduce themselves, their culture, their practices, and their structures. So think about, you know, people have been working to try and make societies more just for a very long time. They made a little progress, but things are still really bad. Remember, I'm from the United States. Guns, shootings, Roe v. Wade going down. We're in a kind of bad moment. Democracy. The United States is not truly a democratic nation anymore. So things are looking really bad for us. So this is part of what motivates this issue about how we can intervene in a system that seems to keep going and going and going. Okay, so two questions I'll discuss today. How and why do oppressive systems reproduce themselves, even when the participants are committed to justice and recognize that the system is unjust? And how can the process of social reproduction be effectively disrupted and replaced so better systems emerge? And I'm just going to scratch the surface. Okay, note, I am not doing normative theory here. I'm back on the handout. I'm asking about the process of social reproduction. How do we make a homeostatic social system more just? So I am really a metaphysician, not a normative theorist. I do philosophy of social science. So I'm really trying to think, what is this object that we are all part of and that we're worried about, that we want to change? Right? It seems to me that we better know more about what it is and how it works before we try to just intervene and change it however we imagine it works. Okay, so social reproduction. I'm going to go for this. So in principle, social reproduction theory considers how any social formation reproduces itself. In practice, the theory has developed as a critical response to a Marxian model that focuses on the economy. Modern social processes not only reproduce class exploitation, but race, sex, class exploitation, you know, in addition to class exploitation, disability sort of oppression and such like that. And the processes in question work not only through wage labor contracts, but through social practices that produce and maintain life and create and distribute forms of non-economic value. So in this picture, the idea is that you've got a Marxian theory of economic reproduction and production of production. And then this is sort of the socialist feminist suggestion that, wait a minute, how did you get the worker? You know, the worker had to be there somehow. Well, women reproduce workers that then fit into the economy, and that has been neglected in thinking about social reproduction. And so the socialist feminists are trying to get the bigger picture. Okay, so structures are the skeletons of systems. So this is the general social reproduction challenge, and I'm just going to take it off on another slightly different direction and not talk about Marx or socialist feminism, so I'm happy to talk about that in the Q&A. So let's go back. So on the handout, a system is a set of things working together in a way that forms a whole. There are different ways to model the relationship between systems and structures. I think of structures as networks of relations that hold between nodes, and systems are dynamic, historically specific instantiations of systems. Now, this came up for me because I gave a talk at one point about structural injustice, and someone asked in the Q&A, well, isn't like systemic justice and structural injustice and institutional injustice, aren't they really words for the same thing? And this is saying, no, they're not words for the same thing. They're slightly different. And understanding their difference is going, I'm going to suggest, is helpful. So there are, so start with systems. There are simple systems like the engine in your car, like the thermostat, like, you know, your computer and these sorts of things. They can sometimes be very complicated, so that's why simple is in scare quotes. There's chaos, which is disorganized complexity. It's like, whoa, and, you know, the climate may be going into chaos. I just read on my Flipboard today. So that is a problem. But in addition, there are complex systems, which are organized complexity. Complex systems are not straightforwardly decomposable into independent parts. So when you take apart the engine in your car, you've got, you know, the various parts, and you can fix them and put them back in, and you can predict how it's going to work because you've just got this part that's been repaired or whatever. The operations on the parts are not necessarily linear, and they're self-organizing and stable due to feedback loops. So one of the reasons why they're not straightforwardly decomposable is the parts have these feedback loops and interact with each other so that you can't just take one out and do something with it, because the interaction it has with the other parts of the system form what it is and constrain what it is. Okay, so this is a picture of a complex system. It's not a society. I think it's a protein, but it was as close as I could get.
The behavior of individuals in the system is unpredictable, but their interactions give rise to stable or emergent features of the whole by virtue of an internal structure. The examples are standardly ecosystems, economies, climate, grains, anthills, and yes, society. Sorry, I have to remain closer to this. I always kind of go like this, like I'm doing to the TV. Like, oh, yeah, that's not the TV, it's this that I have to point to. So the structure of the system affects the individuals in it and the interactions that are possible. That has to do with this thing, these feedback loops. The structure sort of constrains what's going to happen with the individuals that are sort of going, interacting with each other. And in such systems, local interactions can spontaneously self-organize, crucially without external intervention or central authorities. So societies organize themselves. It's not like there's like the king of the universe who decides how everything's going to happen. We kind of just, we're like ant colonies, you know, bits of food in the web. I don't know. We're more like ant colonies, you know, where we're just trying to organize ourselves and get done what we need to get done. Okay, so structures form the skeleton of the system, and they consist of places and relations or nodes and edges. So the idea is that this is sort of embedded in that. And moreover, social relations, which are the edges here or the relations, they're established in practices. So for example, X is a mother of Y. It's a biological relation, but it's also a legal and social relation formed in practice. And yeah, they're just having coffee. They're not actually creating a child or being a mother or whatever, but that's the closest I could get to the right kind of picture, if you know what I mean. Anyway, all of these relations, there are practices here that form them. So I'm an adoptive mother. I'm not a biological mother. I'm very vividly aware of the practices, the legal practices, the social practices, the social work practices, and all of that that made it possible for me to be a mother. And that those practices are constitutive of or have constituted my relationship with my children. Okay. Societies are particular complex dynamic systems that exist at a time, a place, and with a particular culture. So they may be structurally similar to another system at a different time, a different place, and a different culture. So you could think of a society as like, you know, well, I think they come in different sizes. So you could think about a society of people at Oxford, you know, who are employed by or students or whatever at Oxford, right? That is a particular configuration with a particular history at a particular moment. But it has a structure that may be mimicked or very, very similar at another university. So think of the structures as something that can be repeated as a type, repeated in different contexts. Now, every society has a way, for example, of organizing kinship relations, but they differ in the details. If we're seeking to identify injustice, sometimes it's important to consider the kinds of relations that structure the society, but sometimes we have to consider the particular historical instantiation of them in a system because structures interact in different ways in different systems. So an example that I think works pretty well is marriage. So before marriage equality in the United States, there were a lot of people who said marriage itself is a fundamentally oppressive relationship, right? Structure, institution, right? We ought not to have marriage. And those were the people who were going for civil unions, abolish marriage. And then other people say, no. Marriage itself isn't the problem. It's how it's instantiated in this system, this patriarchal system, this heteronormative system, etc. Keep marriage, but change the system that it's in. Okay, so that's two ways of thinking about social change. And I think it's important because by distinguishing structures and systems, we're in a better position to attend not just to the structures, but to their dynamic interdependence in a particular socio-historical context. So that is, I think, a kind of big message here, is that if you've put too much energy into just looking at the structure, abstracted from the system, then you're going to miss some of what's actually happening in social reproduction. Okay, so let's see. I'm going to go back and forget that. So on the second column on page one, so understanding societies as complex systems is important for three reasons I allege.
First, in complex systems, the structure and environment of the system can impose constraints on components in a way that shapes them to fit the structure. Think of adaptation and ecosystems. So we are all adapted to be part of the social system that we're in. We've learned how to manage and coordinate in that system. Second, a complex system isn't decomposable into subsystems or modules that behave independently. Instead, the components of the system depend for their capacities on other components in ways that involve feedback loops. That's just repeating a feature of a complex system. And in applying it to societies, we have to see the interaction between a transportation system, a legal system, a medical system, and such, but also systems of racial oppression, sexist oppression, et cetera, and class oppression. And third, it's helpful to distinguish, as I've just suggested, the systems and structures because they interact with each other. So what is the takeaway from this section? The takeaway is structures are parts of complex overlapping systems that affect how they are sustained. Okay, next section, B on the handout. Social relations are established and maintained in social practices. I hinted at that, but what is a social practice, right? I haven't said anything about that yet. So here's some more pictures. Coordination around resources, and those of you who know my work have heard or seen some of this before, I apologize. I just need it to get to the next step. So coordination around resources, things of negative, positive or negative value, is a fundamental human task, and our ability to develop flexible forms of coordination that can be passed down through social learning is the key to our evolutionary success. You know, we're relatively ill-formed when we come out, and that is an advantage for our species because we get shaped by our culture and our ecological milieu to be able to fit within it. Good niche construction. Okay, so coordination, however, relies on meaning, symbols, default assumptions, and associations, that is culture, or what I call a cultural techne to shape our behavior. Now, I call it a cultural techne, not just culture, because culture is a word that has been used for a long time and is very controversial, and anthropologists have even stopped using it for the most part because of its problematic associations. And I pick cultural techne because I want us to think of culture as a set of tools. So it's not as if there's a culture of Oxford and you all are just little robots or automata sort of enacting the culture or whatever. What it offers you is a set of tools, of concepts, of background assumptions, a set of norms that you have picked up, that you use in different contexts in different ways. You're still an agent in using those tools. Okay, so in the case of humans in general, we not only learn what is edible, but develop cuisines, menus, daily and holiday rituals, so you develop skills for cooking. You know what is supposed to be eaten at certain special holidays and events. So here's a cedar waxwing, a beautiful, my favorite bird actually, and cedar waxwings have pre-installed capacities for eating, so finding as food, little red round things. Holly berries are some of their favorite, but if you threw red beads on the ground, they would go and try to eat them, right? Because they didn't have to learn from the mama and papa cedar waxwing what to eat. But we're not like that. We have to learn that some berries are poison and some are not. We have to develop a taste for certain kinds of berries. Cranberries, they are so tart and sour, but when you put them with sugar and make cranberry sauce, they're delicious. So this is something, the way that we differ, and we differ through social learning. We learn it from our peers, our parents, et cetera, et cetera. So my view is in contrast to some of the other views on sociality, that I don't think that sociality is all about collective intentionality and joint agency and all of that stuff. That is way, way, way too cognitive. There are cultures and groups of apes, right? We know a lot about different ways in which non-linguistic creatures are capable of developing practices that they share with each other and pass down. Okay. On my account, and I'm not going to say a lot about this today, but just so you know, an ideology is a cultural technique gone wrong.
It's a set of tools that obscures and distorts what is valuable and or organizes us in unjust ways. So, any human behavior is conditioned by multiple factors. Here's a meal. It's constrained by the physical demands of the human body, the geographical context and the edible things in it, the social, political, legal context, what makes certain edibles salient, available, and safe, the economic constraints on what we can afford, and the social meaning of the different foodstuffs. So Trump, when he was in office, it's traditional for the president to invite the champions of the NCAA, the Collegiate Athletic Association, to the White House to celebrate their championship. And the football championship, in the sense of American football championship, he invited the Clemson football team to the White House and served them fast food. He served them Burger King and McDonald's. Now, many people thought this was ridiculous. Why did they think it was ridiculous? Because the social meaning of a banquet at the White House suggests you don't serve fast food, especially when the majority of the people on the team are African Americans who probably grew up in food deserts. And so there was this sense that this is what they would like because this is what they're used to, which is, you know, racist too, right? That's a kind of a problematic attitude. Like they couldn't really handle a proper banquet. Anyway, so social meaning is a crucial part of how we manage our lives together. So public meanings are internalized as we learn the languages of our local cultures. This is the basis for our fluency in social skills and capacities for code switching. For example, I share some cultural tools with philosophical colleagues across the globe. Here, I know what a public lecture is like, right? But do my neighbors? No, they would not know what to do if they walked in here. And so others with my dogs. My dear dog Sparky, we had to put him down because, this is not Sparky. This is another random dog off the internet. But we have social relations that we teach our dogs, we train our dogs to sort of respond to us and listen to us. And they train us to do things like what to do when they need to go out. They signal to us. So we open the door. So we have this mutual training that happens. Tools that are desired for one purpose are used for other purposes, including critique, and bricolage is a term from Levi-Strauss, where it's the idea of a handyman, a bricoleur, who picks up things, so uses a screwdriver to open a paint can, right? Those sorts of things. And we do the same with our cultural tools. A quote from William Sewell, a social historian, mainly worked on the French Revolution, brilliant, wonderful social theorist. He says, users of a culture will form a semiotic community in the sense that they will recognize the same set of oppositions, or what I'm thinking of as social meanings, and therefore be capable of engaging in mutually meaningful symbolic action. To use the ubiquitous linguistic analogy, they will be capable of using the grammar of the semiotic system to make understandable utterances. So, for example, if I showed up today in a bathing suit, you would think, oh my God, what is she doing? Right? Because that semiotic sort of signal is inappropriate for giving a heart lecture, right? You don't do things like that. And so what would I be saying? You'd be thinking, what is she doing? Why is she doing that? Because you're looking for the meaning of my agency. And even though it's right and proper for me to look like a smart casual, is that what it is? Anyway, something like that. That if I'm clearly disobeying that norm, then you need to look for the meaning of what I'm really trying to say to you. Okay, so here we are, and this is where I am, is on the italicized part on the under B, and I will go through this. This is just a picture, and then the rest of it is mostly doing the reading, just reading. So here we are trying to coordinate, and what I say is there's a practice here, and the practice consists of a set of public meanings and a set of resources. So here's a bunny, and we might interpret the bunny as a pet or as food or as a pelt, and suppose we interpret it as a pet. That's the dominant understanding of bunnies. We live in a city, we don't see them a lot, maybe, and so they're not wild. And then we internalize these schemas, which are the public meanings, and that shapes our way that we perceive them, what we perceive about them, what we remember. And through, after that filtering, we form attitudes like, oh, let me pet the bunny. It was a wild bunny or a pelt. You might not do that. And so you interact with the resource, and then that reinforces the meaning, because we then breed bunnies to be really fat and slow and soft and not to poop too much, you know, because we want them as pets. That's how we do it. And that reinforces, see, this is a pet. It's not wild. This also happens with women. Is she a friend? Is she a mother? Is she a sex object? Depending on the context and the schema, we might interpret a human through these different lenses, and the same for a black man, a friend, a janitor, or a criminal. So here's what I've just said in words rather than in pictures, and it's on the handout. Social practices are patterns of learned behavior that enable us, that is, living beings, to coordinate as members of a group in creating, using, distributing, managing, maintaining, and eliminating a resource or resources due to mutual responsiveness to each other's behavior and the resources in question as interpreted through these social meanings. So we coordinate because we have a shared understanding of, look, we get so much information from our senses, and we have to sort through it. We have to figure out what to pay attention to, what to remember, what is the signal of what, because we're trying to coordinate. And so the being socialized is to learn the social meanings so that we can pick up the relevant information, form the dispositions to act, and act on it appropriately in the social context. So that's what a social practice is. And the cultural techné is going to be specific to particular practices. But you can also think of a broad one that has very general. So gender is a part of a very broad cultural technique, so is race. But, you know, professor of jurisprudence, that's kind of specific. That's more specific to a certain set of practices in a certain institution. Okay, so let's now go back. Okay, here we are. So let's hope. So on this view, I'm not going to go into what the elements are. So on this view, at the bottom of two, of the second column, sociality is not unique to humans. It's grounded in social learning rather than collective intentionality, and language is not needed. Practices are not rule-governed, and they're not driven or manifested by purely cognitive processes. They have affective dimensions, and Peter Milton is wonderful in his work on talking about the interaction between the cognitive and the affective in developing front responses to others and acting. Thank you, Peter, for your work on that. And second page, practices emerge in response to both the material world and others with whom coordination is needed, and they have material components. Eating a meal is a practice that involves food. Again, this is a kind of pointed complaint about a lot of the social ontology literature, which was all about joint intentionality, where it seems like the social world could just be in our heads. And I'm saying, no, you know, I think a transportation system has trains in it, and we don't. And meals have food in it, etc. Or that would be bad if it didn't. Okay. And then an ideology is a cultural techné gone wrong. It distorts our appreciation of what's valuable, distributes what's valuable in unjust ways, or organizes us in ways that are wrongful or harmful. Okay, so the takeaway is social structures are not all institutional. So if you think you're going to address structural injustice by changing institutions, you've left a lot out. That may help, but you've left a lot out, because not all structures are institutional. Not all of them are laws or policies or such like that. Because practices create those relations that are in the network, right, of relations that constitute the social system. Remember the three pictures, right, that the networky thing, and then the Okay, so structural stability. On the handout. So why are systems, especially unjust systems, so stable? Kaylin O'Connor provides some insight, and she's not doing
cultural evolution here. She's doing this is a model for how it might work that that derives from evolution and game theory. So she says, what are the minimal conditions under which social inequality would emerge and be stable? She suggests that there are two kinds of coordination problems. One is a correlative problem. And a correlative problem is one where the best solution requires us all to do the same thing. Drive on the right, drive on the left. Complementary problems are the best solution requires us to act differently, but in sync. Ballroom dancing is an example. Step forward if you're a woman and back if you're a man. Complementary problems are solved by establishing roles that are suitably related. But in addition to roles, we need to identify who functions in what role. We do this by relying on markers of social categories. Moreover, there are advantages to having broad categories rather than specific ones for each practice, because this enables members of the group to build up broad competencies, form networks, and develop identities. So you might see where this is going. So women might be marked. It's a social category. And look, you might, it's kind of, if you have, you know, a different kind of person for every job, then you don't get that there's sort of relevant competencies that people who care for children might have, like cooking or cleaning or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So what you do is the roles that it might be very specific in one, and for one purpose, they end up getting broader so that you end up deciding how you're going to ballroom dance depending on whether you're a man or a woman, whether you step forward or step back. Whoa, that doesn't seem absolutely necessary. Anyway, so O'Connor argues, once categories have been adopted, the cultural dynamics that lead to bargaining norms are radically changed. New norms that are inequitable but not especially efficient arise. And once they do, they can be self-perpetuating. In other words, the development of types sets the stage for serious inequity to spontaneously emerge and to persist between social groups. So here's an example. If Alice and Bob are bargaining, and Alice is invested in the care of another, her infant, and Bob is not, what happens? Alice's options are more limited than Bob's, for Alice will not accept a bargain in which the dependent's well-being is compromised. This is where a disagreement point becomes a threat point. So that's kind of technical language. But a threat point is where I got you, and you're going to have to take a lower payment in the bargaining scheme, a lower payout in the bargaining scheme. In such bargaining context, she argues, power differentials between bargaining agents become salient. Suppose one player is able to issue a more credible threat than the other. I'm going to divorce you, and you're going to be poor and have to take care of the children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there are all kinds of ways in which there can be credible threats by someone who has more power and has more freedom and has less responsibility. Because the less powerful player now stands to lose more should the bargaining fail, the more powerful player derives an advantage. So she goes on, the social division of labor has positioned women as a whole as caregivers and men as not. This has the result that women are systematically disadvantaged. And quote, small differences of inequity between genders can feed into processes that generate more serious inequity. And as you see, Ginger Rogers had to do everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards and in high heels, just saying. Okay. Expanding on this, there are several sources of stability. Power. So practices define roles that come with burdens and benefits, and in doing so, they also distribute power. Who has access to the valued stuff? Who can produce it, own it, withhold it? And who is burdened with responsibility? Intelligibility. A cultural techne provides tools to make sense of ourselves, of others, and the world. Action that conforms to one's place in a social practice is intelligible to others. And if one strays too far, one is misinterpreted, punished, and viewed as only a questionable member of the community. And those are bad options. So if you stop doing what people in your category are supposed to do, that you're going to be punished for it, or you're going to be treated as stupid, or you're going to be treated as resistant. And so we do tend to conform to our category requirements because that is what enables us to be successful in coordinating with others. And coordination is absolutely crucial. And then finally, materiality. Practices shape the material conditions in ways that shape change. Feedback loops, remember we talked about those, and social niche construction shape our environment to accommodate our practices. So interstate highways, right? These big, monstrous concrete networks. They're very expensive to tear up, right? And it's going to be hard to change them. In Long Island, just as I know I'm taking too long, but in Long Island, there was a man named Robert Moses, not the Bob Moses of SNCC, but Robert Moses. He designed the roads out Long Island. Long Island is a very ritzy area. And he made all the bridges low enough so that public buses couldn't get through. Why did he do that? Because he didn't want the riffraff to be going out on Long Island. He wanted the rich people with cars to go to Long Island. So now, if you want to have public transit, want buses to go to Long Island, you've got to rip up all those bridges, right? That's expensive. That's a case where the material conditions make social change difficult, and this happens all the time. Even if we want and need to change our practices, it may be difficult. But I have to take my little rant here. Someone needs to pass a Disabilities Act in the UK. I have a disabled husband, and it's incredible how few curb cuts there are. You know, it just makes me think someone doesn't care. Because you can't, so many places, you can't get access, not because they're stairs. There's not a curb cut. Just saying. Okay, now I'm done. Okay, the ADA, brilliant, 1990, U.S. ADA, everything. Okay, so practices. Takeaway, practices are embedded in systems that create significant strength and incentives to conform, even if we don't want to and we don't think it's best overall. So this is that point about we don't want it to be like this, but lo and behold, here we're doing it. But why are we doing it? Because we don't have any alternatives. Either it's not materially possible, we would be unintelligible, or there's someone who has power to force us through bad bargains to do it this way. Okay, that's the social reproduction part. My part, that answer, remember the first question was how does social reproduction work? And the second was, and what are we going to do about it? So now let's turn to what are we going to do about it. I feel like I'm teaching, I'm saying, any questions? But I know you have to wait. I prefer, anyway. So social change and the law. Are we going to this part? Here we go. Let us now turn to social change in pursuit of justice. How is systemic change possible? Given the account of practices I favor, to change a structure, we should change the practices that constitute the structure. Okay, so here we are. Remember, I told you this is the picture, just same as before. So the material and semiotic conditions, so I use semiotic for just the social meaning stuff, of coordination, make available certain choice architectures. An agency outside the choice architecture can be physically impossible, legally forbidden, or socially unintelligible. So what do we need to change? It looks like if the practices are creating the relations that form the structure, then we've got to look at this stuff. We've got to look at the social meanings and the resources. And those of us who think, I tend to think that change the material conditions, that's going to be really important. If you change the material conditions, people start doing things differently, right? But it's not just that. We have to change the social meaning because if it really is, it has a bad meaning to interact with the material resource this way, then you're probably not going to do it even if it's easy, right? So you've got to work on both of them. You've got to work on both of them. Now, private action, some people, again, the people I'm implicitly arguing against, think that, oh, no, we just have to get rid of implicit bias, and we just have to occasionally do the laundry. Certain people occasionally do the laundry. And, you know, private action has limited impact in changing entrenched social structures. If you're, like John Legend has just recently come out, and so, anyway, never mind, Paul Robeson, they're artists. There are famous charismatic people who are promoting causes. Their action can make a difference. But this is different. I'm talking about private action, not public action by celebrities. Okay, so I think law contributes its own social meanings, resources, and practices to the system.
The laws and legal concepts are part of the cultural technique. So the concept of marriage, the concept of rape, both of them, law has had a huge influence in adjusting and changing. Gender is one that's contested, and law has the power to change that. In Massachusetts, sincere self-avowal of gender identity is sufficient to have your documents changed, and law helps us with that. Laws and elements of the legal apparatus are resources to be interpreted and managed. So Peter also suggested to me at one point that can these social meanings in turn sometimes become resources? And I think the term woman has become, it's a bit of language, and it has become a resource that we're fighting over and trying to figure out how to manage, how to distribute, who to distribute that term, who counts as a woman and who doesn't. So I think that's extremely important. And law is also a set of practices. Okay, so let me go. Let's go to page 3. I just went through that. So, under the bullet, keeping in mind these senses of law, just social justice efforts may target a particular law or set of laws, an interpretation of the law. Very often that's crucial. So that's a cultural, there's a practice in the legal system for interpretation, and that practice is informed by its own sort of set of skills. That's why people go to law school. A set of skills for interpretation, that's the cultural techne of law, and that can make a big difference in determining what our ongoing choice architecture is. Okay, so let's look at law and social meanings. One primary strategy for bringing about greater social justice is to change laws as directives or their interpretation. However, because law is only one component of a complex system, the consequences of such initiatives are unpredictable and only have an impact on the structure if they're meaningfully taken up into practice. So this is Brown v. Board of Education picture, just right after Brown v. Board of Education when integration was mandated in the U.S. It took many years for anything to happen in response to Brown. There were, Virginia, for example, closed some of its school districts and did not offer public education because they didn't want to have integrated education, so everyone had to go to private school, right, because they didn't want to conform. It's been bad, right? And then the civil rights movement really worked to change this, but many of the segregation, the desegregation orders were lifted in the 1990s, and there is a ProPublica article that provides evidence that those school districts where there were desegregation orders are as segregated now as they were before Roe, right? Because things have just reverted back. So it's very, Roe, I'm not saying Roe is a bad idea. Oh, do you know Roe? I'm speaking about Roe. Roe is I'm not saying it's a bad idea, but even if it was a fantastic idea, it was working in a system where cultural racism was so strong, where the norms for white people and black people and how they interact were so powerful that it was very difficult for it to have the intended effects. Okay, so a strategy is this. Okay, so how is law taken up in culture? So here is another example. So Lawrence Lessig has argued that law can truthfully be used to shift social meaning. Both he and Anthony Appiah have written about legal efforts in the 19th century to stop dueling in the American South. On Lessig's account, two strategies stand out. One strategy aimed to eliminate dueling simply by banning it from social life. The other aimed to eliminate it simply by changing its social meaning. But what does this mean? Okay. So the first strategy, just banning it, was not successful. So when Burr and Hamilton dueled, it was both illegal in New York, they dueled in New Jersey.
It was, and they lived in New York. They went to New Jersey to duel because they thought they would be penalized less. Because it was illegal in both places, right? They didn't, and it turned out that Burr was charged with murder because he killed Hamilton. Hamilton shot in the air, and Burr, you know, shot Hamilton. Anyway, so, and Burr was charged with murder, but it never went anywhere because people were still into dueling. Okay, so the first strategy was unsuccessful of just making it illegal, but Lessig argues, proscription here fails in part because it directly challenges the norms of loyalty built within the social structure. These norms can be quite strong. Within the elite's rhetorical structure, law banning dueling was not sufficient to refuse to duel. The second strategy, however, focusing on social meaning, was successful. So how did it work? Here's a long quote. An individual participating in a duel was barred from public office after the duel. Holding public office, or more importantly, serving the public, was itself a duty of the elite. Thus, exclusion created a conflict in the duties faced by the elite, and hence an elite-based reason for refusing the challenge of a duel. What is different about the second proscription is that it functions within the elite's rhetorical structure, I would say its semiotic structure, to undermine the very basis of dueling itself. A gentleman could appeal to a gentleman's duty in escaping the duel rather than appealing to self-interest or the rules of the commoners. Okay, so the meaning of dueling was moved by the law. The law said, okay, if you're in a duel, you can't hold public office, you can't do any of these other things that you elite people need to do. And so you say, I challenge you to a duel. And he says, on my honor and as elite, you know, I'm not going to duel because it's my duty to hold public office. Okay, that's how it worked. So it's an excellent example of how social meanings interact in structures and more generally how law and culture are intertwined. But of course, things are not always so simple or as successful, for the weight and breadth of social meaning may surpass the ingenuity of lawmakers. For example, the social meaning of race remains a dominant force in shaping U.S. social structures in spite of lifetimes of legal efforts to displace it. Yeah, race and gender, they're like really, really deep. So law is also a valuable mechanism. This is more obvious in managing resources. The Americans with Disabilities Act has distributed access to public space more justly and has also changed the social meaning of disability, tax law, blah, blah, blah. You all know that. Okay, so the takeaway here is ordinary individual agency is usually ineffective in changing big systems, and small ones are embedded in big ones. So families, they're embedded in. So I can try to change the norms for how things work in my family, but my family is affected by the cultural techne of families and gender and race and all of that stuff too. So I can try, but it's hard. It's really hard. Law can sometimes help change practices by changing social meanings and the material conditions. Okay, so changing culture, the limitations of law alone. I hope we can agree that the legal system, at least in the United States, plays a huge role in upholding the status quo and its economic and status hierarchies, and does not overall promote social justice, although I may admit there are some exceptions. Often legal change is more effective if it arises out of social movements that have already, to some extent, shifted practices. For example, many find it surprising how quickly marriage equality laws were passed in the United States, but the LGBTQ rights movement, which is here, this was the year after the Stonewall Uprising, worked for decades to shift understandings of same-sex relationships and to integrate them into more traditional family structures. In some places, the change of law was a formal recognition of the work that was done in the social movement. Right? It wasn't like the law said, okay, let's have marriage equality. And everyone's going, what? Marriage equality? That was kind of how it happened with integration. Not quite. But so what happened is that people were getting married in non-state, non-religious marriages all the time. And then it was more a recognition that's happening, and let's give that some legal recognition. In some places, the change of laws was a more formal recognition of this work. And the reason I think so we ought to pay attention to social movements
is they have greater freedom than legal institutions to rethink our background assumptions and disrupt the status quo. Legal practice has power by virtue of being backed by the state, and that also constrains it. Okay, so deep engagement between the two, right? The social movement having allies in the legislature and then lawyers who represent them at the Supreme Court, etc. Those are incredible, but I think there needs to be a close interaction. But social movements provide more than support for legal change. They're typically concerned with cultural change beyond law, and such cultural change is necessary to achieve justice. So, three reasons why. Not all oppression falls within the scope of law or policy. Apologies to the grammatical correction that I need to make. Falls within the scope of law or policy, especially within the context of liberalism. Women and girls are treated unjustly in families, but the division of labor in the family is not considered a matter for the state to control. Although law may incentivize some fairer practices, the public-private distinction still remains a crucial barrier to true social justice. But it's not the only barrier. Iris Young argues that oppression is a group-based injustice that takes five forms: exploitation, marginalization, powerlessness, cultural imperialism, and systematic violence. I would love to go into that in detail, but this is more of a note to those of you who know some about Young. But they're all sustained by ideology. And remember, an ideology is a cultural technique gone wrong. The ideology is that set of tools that narrows our vision and narrows our understanding of what is valuable, has us look at things. So you look at someone and you go, oh, white, or woman, or man, or disabled, or like that. That comes to you before you even talk to the person, before you have any understanding of what's going on. Bingo! That's one of the first things you notice. And it really distorts our perceptual capacities to rely so crucially on these cultural techniques. So we need to change culture. Although law can nudge social meanings, it can't reach into the domain where culture guides how and what we value, at least under liberalism, because liberalism's not supposed to do that, right? Well, comprehensive liberalism, yes, but many kinds of liberalism that you find in the United States are not supposed to touch that. Secondly, social movements do not simply hand down directives, but create alternative practices, seeking ones that work in context with the aim of spreading them to others. So think of Stonewall. So the LGBTQ movement started so much in gay and lesbian bars where people were experimenting with different ways of partnering and doing sex and having fun, right? Different and alternative ways of being in the world. Some ways, yeah, didn't work so well, and they changed and they modified them because they were experiments in living, as Anderson and others have talked about. So this allows the movement to benefit from local knowledge, from participants' sensitivity to existing social meanings and practices. Oftentimes people from outside come in and say, okay, we're going to make the social meaning go this way. And the people who are going to be affected go, no, not that way. That's not working for us. And from counter-publics and small-scale experiments in living, like the LGBTQ bars. Movements create new social networks, which is a well-established method for creating positive feedback loops that change complex systems. So if you're interested in this network theory, social network theory is really interesting. And it's not just human networks, all kinds of networks, networks in other living systems and organisms and stuff like that. Co-designing new practices together in through the social movement is empowering to those directly affected and I think has a greater democratic legitimacy than having top-down control. And if you're interested in that, the failures of top-down state control, Eleanor Ostrom, brilliant, The Problem of the Commons, wonderful stuff. Okay, third, although a legitimate social movement must be empirically and morally justified, because, of course, not all social movements promote justice, and as I said, I'm not doing normative theory or normative epistemology here, I've got other work on that, it is a major question to figure out which are the legitimate social movements, which are the social movements that are promoting justice and which not. I'm not going to give you an answer to that question today, but what I'm saying is that social movements help are an important source, and that's good to know even when the bad ones are getting power, right? B- because they're finding ways to disrupt the system that we need to be sensitive to. We need to be aware of, because they have tremendous power once they get control of the social meaning. So the social meaning of abortion, the pro, I call them anti-abortion, but other people call them pro-life, population, has completely altered the understanding of women's bodies and pregnancy, and I'm going to rant, but I'm so I'll stop. Okay, so in the vast majority of moral disagreements, argumentation is not effective in changing minds. This is a philosopher's problem. They think, okay, someone disagrees with me, let's have a good discussion. No, not happening. It's not going to work so well. Okay. Moreover, as I argued above, changing individual minds does not change the practices that are the established mode of coordination. My mind has been changed about a lot of things, but there's nothing I can do. When my food co-op, like I'm a vegan and I care deeply about the environment, but when my food co-op was moved out of my neighborhood, I had a choice. Are you going to drive to the other side of Boston in your car to go to the food co-op that's not on public transportation? That seems a little self-defeating. Or are you going to buy from Target? You don't probably have Target. Target is a big mega store. You know, no, I don't want to. Anyway, so, okay. See, this is what happens if you let me talk too much. I start getting carried away. That's why I have to stick to the script. Okay, stick to the script. Changing individual minds does not change practices that are established mode of coordination. Although legal interventions provide nudges and sanctions that can be helpful, conformity to a new norm based on sanctions is not stable. Instead of relying wholly on reason, debate, social movements prompt paradigm shifts and understanding the social world through practical engagement with others. So what you want to do is you don't want to go, oh, let's do normal moral theory here and just use our arguments that are already embedded in the cultural technique that we can, that can work sometimes, but sometimes that doesn't work because it's too constrained. What you want to do is offer the option of a paradigm shift. So think of Kuhn on the structure of scientific revolutions. Here's the takeaway. Many social movements aim for cultural change, sometimes in addition to legal change. Such movements address injustice in ways that are well suited to complex dynamic systems, for they target a broad range of practices that form social relations, offer alternative social meanings, and disrupt material conditions by demonstrations, street occupations, you know, strikes and stuff like that, that call sometimes for technological intervention. I'll explain that later. Okay, so conclusion. Is there a message here for academics? Legal theorists. Is there a message here for academics, legal theorists, and philosophers? Maybe we can play a role in informing legal arguments or provide principles of justice, but is it really our job to change culture? You know, we're academics, right? What are we doing? We're philosophers. We're not, you know, literary theorists or something. We're not artists. You know, we're trying to reason, debate, and all of that. So I've suggested that law can change culture by shifting social meanings. It can support social movement work by formalizing changes that have been achieved in practice. And philosophers can develop normative principles to guide our interventions into unjust structures. But this isn't all. In my experience, many philosophers and other academics take themselves to be theorists rather than activists, as if one cannot be both. I've had people say that to me. They suppose that theory is not a form of activism. This seems to assume that activists are illiterate or stupid, or that they're not interested in theory. Don't activists just make signs with simplistic slogans? Yeah, they do. But that's not all we do. Okay, that's deeply misguided. Theory, including philosophy, is a crucial part of any social movement. They rely on critique of what's taken for granted. The movements rely on a critique of what's taken for granted, what everyone knows, the world as we live it, and as ideology has made it. Shifting consciousness, I think, is at the heart of philosophy. In addition, movements are called upon to critically engage dominant paradigms, to offer alternative explanations, and to construct new tools for thought and action. Again, sounds like philosophy. Philosophical work isn't only happening in classrooms and academic offices, and work that does happen in classrooms and offices
plays a role in activism. So to close, I give you two quotes. It will take everything you have to steer the future away from endless war, from the annihilation of those treasures, and the grinding down of the poor and the marginal. And these are the right dates, not the one on the handout. And Audre Lorde says, sometimes we're blessed with being able to choose the time and the arena and the manner of our revolution, but more usually we must do battle where we're standing. So I think where we're standing is here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sally, for that passionate, insightful, provocative lecture. We have a bit of time for questions before we retire to the garden.
And if you're just confused about anything, just feel free to ask. I'm happy to take clarification or whatever.
Okay. First up, we have Professor Scott Brewer of Harvard.
Hi.
And we don't have mics, so please speak up.
Okay. Thank you for an outstanding lecture. I have a question about your claim that argumentation is not effective at changing minds, and as you point out, philosophers will sort of resist that idea. But I want to press you a little bit on what you regard as argumentation.
Good question.
Because when you talk about a paradigm shift, right, I think that paradigm shifts are a shift in explaining, and I think explaining is a type of argument, which is abduction.
Yes.
So I think a lot of these changes come about because people have a new way of understanding, which is a new way of explaining, which is a new way of arguing, both to themselves and to others. So that's one,
yes.
one question. The other question is, your model seems sort of, like in the first part of your lecture, the model seemed very determining and deterministic. And I'm just wondering if you can say a word about how is it that you think people break out of these structures,
mm-hmm.
that black people do things that black people weren't supposed to do, or women do things
yes.
that women weren't supposed to do, or philosophers do things that philosophers weren't supposed
yes.
to do, like Wittgenstein, or Paul Feyerabend, or, you know, Nietzsche, for that matter.
Right.
So.
Thank you. Both of them are excellent questions. So the first is, what do I mean by argumentation, and it's really argumentation so at odds with what I'm doing, and I agree with you. I was thinking of a narrow conception of argumentation that you find in a journal that I'm an associate editor of, but like ethics. So I read a lot of the papers in ethics, and they seem to be kind of argumentation for conclusions that aren't the kind of argument that is going to provide a paradigm shift and aren't going to be very effective in discussions with people you disagree with. They're a very narrow frame of, a very narrow cultural technique there in what happens. So I'm thinking of, now there are two ways that argumentation can help. So if you're arguing in front of the Supreme Court, or if you're arguing even a case in a county court or whatever like that, argumentation can make a difference. And I'm not saying it can never make a difference. But I am interested in these paradigm shifts. And you're right that what paradigm shifts do is offer a new explanatory model. But I think that I'm with Feyerabend in the sense that you can't get there exactly just by arguing your way from the normal norms for what counts as a good argument to this new one. What has to happen is you have to have a new set of tools that you take up because they function better. And my view about moral epistemology is sometimes what Kuhn would have said is, look, recalcitrant data, now a new model. And I think that's what happens sometimes when in moral theory is that you keep running, you experience things as problematic. You experience this as problematic, and you don't have the tools, the conceptual tools. So in the sexual harassment example, that was a very standardized kind of model. There was flirting in the workplace, and the women kept saying, no, this isn't just flirting, no, this is not bad, no, this is what, we need a new paradigm. The paradigm is a civil rights, you know, offense, and this is a new concept. So it is a kind of argument. I don't want to say the argument is never useful or say
there's no form of argument that this takes. So I really want to accept your point. Now, in terms of how we, so I don't think it's deterministic at all because, again, I think that we are, humans are creative and clever, and we use tools in many different ways. So that Greek collage example, you know, a screwdriver, paint can. So you can use tools in one place for another place. And I'm going to give you a quick example. So my sister, who's quite a bit older than I am, went to an all-girls high school, women's college, trained to be a teacher, an elementary school teacher, then got married, quit her job, had two kids, stayed home. And then she got a job when her kids were tweens. And she called me one day and she said, Sally, I said, Mary, how do you like your job? And she said, well, it's so interesting because when I'm at work, I get rewarded for the littlest thing I do competently. Everyone goes, wow, you did that great. I never get that reward at home. Nobody recognizes that I've done anything at home. Because she had two sons and a husband. Anyway, I just feel like I never get any gratitude or recognition. But at work, it makes every day I come home feeling like I'm doing better. She says, on the other hand, at work, I have to have my lunch from 12 to 1. And I don't want to eat at 12. I'm not even hungry at 12. Why do I have to do it 12 to 1? I had so much freedom at home compared to how I ever worked. And this is what I'm thinking of, right? Is that and this is what I think what happens with Du Bois and double consciousness. If you occupy different social milieus and social practices, and then you can see both of them, you can think, whoa, something is messed up. There's something that's not right about 12. And so actually Du Bois in the Souls of Black Folk in the first chapter of the Souls of Black Folk, the discussion, he talks about the two-ness of Black Folk, using his term Black Folk, in that time, because he's saying there's not only the double consciousness, but there's this kind of two-ness because you both love America and you love your people. And how can you combine that and take the best of both? Anyway, I think that's really important because that's one of the ways that you can begin to see that these two spheres are inadequate, but we can make them better. Another is, I just think we do have, because we're social creatures, we have a disposition that you can find in other social creatures to care about other members of your coordination group. Right. If you have to rely on someone to hunt another wolf to hunt, and that wolf gets hurt, you need to care about that wolf, right? Because that'll make your hunting less effective, and that's important. So there's a kind of care built into some of our pre-installed dispositions, I think, that can be totally obliterated and destroyed. But I think that there is some of that, and there's also considerations of equity that you can find in non-linguistic creatures that I think a sense of fairness, right? If something is unfair, you see these, Franz de Waal has these great videos of primates throwing the celery or cucumber back at the handler because the other primate got grapes. Anyway,
great, thank you.
I know I'm going on too long. Okay,
so
just tell me.
I'm just going to ask people to both questioner and responder to be succinct and then reply.
I have so much to say.
We're going to go over a little. I think that's going to be okay. We started a little late. Okay, for the benefit of the audio, I'm going to say a little bit about who you are, if I know who you are. Next up, we have John Tassioulis, who is a philosopher and the director of the Oxford Institute for Ethics and AI.
Sympathetic to your overall message that there's a lot of social justice that falls outside the remit of law. But let me ask you how someone who didn't find that convincing might press you. So one thought would be this. A lot of people think intuitively there's a powerful connection between law and justice. That if you want to know what justice is, somehow that's related to law. So take, for example, Kant, who says you can have perfect justice in a nation of devils. And the reason he thinks that is because those devils, if they were law compliant, would be acting justly, even though in other respects they were bad. And equally, John Locke seems to imply that only those rights that are properly upheld through law count as what justice is. So So the question then becomes, on this kind of narrow question, they're using this social phenomenon to demarcate the scope of justice. How are you demarcating the scope of justice if you're giving up that, and why are you giving that up? The second question is this. You gave us a very differentiated account of social phenomena, and you talked about structures, you talked about systems, ideologies, cultural technique, etc. But you gave an undifferentiated account for the purposes of this talk of social justice. Now, you look at someone like Rawls, he'll say, well, social justice is social justice because it's about a particular kind of social phenomenon. He calls it the basic structure. Are you asserting any claim like that, that your differentiated picture somehow helps pick out what's social justice versus other goodies that we might like? Or is social justice all the goodies we might like?
Yeah, okay, before you respond, can you hold those in your head?
So let me write a note.
I want to get the last questioner in, and then we're going to let Sally respond to both. We have a final question from Professor Kate O'Regan, who is the director of the Bonavera Center for Human Rights and a former very highfalutin, but I don't know the exact title, justice in the intro.
Thanks, Ruth, and thanks, Sally, for a really interesting presentation. So my point is on a little bit from John's question. And perhaps even from the question before that, it all sounds in some ways very stable. You say you can't change it. How do you account for deep patterns of polarization and deep kind of questions of conflict over material issues and political issues, which of course are so represented in the US, within the system which you account for as being very stable? With very, very different cultures arising, deep disagreements about them, how does that fit in with this sort of one complex structure?
Good, thank you. So I think I'm going to start and then I'll come back to you.
Okay, so I don't want to really argue about who gets to use the term justice, and I'm happy to give it away if someone else. I like oppression anyway, so I'd be happy to just talk about oppression. I do think that, you know, Rawls talks about justice as fairness, and certainly fairness is not just about the state, right? You can have unfairness, right? And you can have unfairness in communities that don't have a state, right? So there's a kind of injustice, I think, that isn't attached to the state or to law or to anything like that, because you can see it in all kinds of places, right? And so I'm interested in that. But if you want the term justice, that's fine. You can have it. And I think the second question about social justice is really good, and I'm not sure that I have an adequate answer. So in the work that I'm most familiar with, there are certain issues that fall under a notion of oppression that aren't just all bad things, right? Oppression is a circumscribed area where I think, if I can just throw, it's a bit of a throwaway, but I think it has to do with your inclusion or exclusion from the social community, and how that works. So if you think about and the relations that you're allowed to enter into within the social. So if you think about young exploitation, you're in it, but you're like women are emotionally exploited, workers are exploited by their labor. You're in it. But you're in it in a way as a tool to assist others like that. Marginalization is, no, it's like the disabled and the elderly. You are pushed outside. You are not people that we think are fully incorporable.
Is that a word?
Anyway, fully included or need to be fully included in our polity. Then you think of powerlessness. You're in it, but you don't get to make the decisions. Someone else gets to make all the decisions, so the wage worker as opposed to the salaried worker. And so it's about, and then systematic violence, obviously, whatever, and cultural imperialism, these are all. So it's about how we're circumscribing our membership in and our role in, think of the categories and Kaelin's work, and the categories that constrain you within that system of coordination. So I mostly think of social philosophy as about our systems of coordination and how they work. And there's all kinds of stuff that is ethical and moral that doesn't concern that. It's like what I do in my spare time, right? Or what I happen to eat, or you know, the ways in which I treat my dog, maybe, or something like that. But that could be social because dogs are part of our social community and whatever like that. So, does that come some way toward answering your question?
How would that deal with oppression between communities?
Are you thinking like nations? Or are you thinking
like
neighborhoods? So nations, So I think that we live in a global community at this point, and the coordination systems are very broad. But again, we have to look at these different systems and how they interact with each other, and it's really beyond my conceptual ability at this point. But I do think there's a kind of global economy, and there's a global... You know, Americans have created and had a huge influence on global culture as well. And so, and those norms, I mean, there are arguments that the colonists brought binary gender into colonized countries, right? Now, that's a Lugones claim. No, I'm a little hesitant to accept it, but it's an interesting thought about this great reach of colonialism. That's a cultural one. I wanted to say not just economic, but cultural as well. On polarization, so I don't think that complex systems are not so stable. There's stability on the edge of chaos. So what happens is that there's different things that can happen. You can nudge it into chaos, which is bad, like violent revolution, you know, absolute, you know, whatever. Or you can also, I mean, what's important about them is that you can't exactly predict what's going to happen. But small changes can have cascading effects. So the shooting of Martin Luther King, he had such social meaning that can have a great impact. Or the overturning of Roe, that's going to have a big impact. And so that there are these certain things that are especially important leverage points that can have a cascading effect. And sometimes it's just small incremental. Here it is, where the system is kind of moving. It's like an ecosystem. Ecosystems do this, and then sometimes they change quite dramatically. So if you're interested in how it works, think of ecosystems and how ecosystems, and then they can also be destroyed and just like fall apart. Polarization, I think I'm most familiar with it in the United States. I don't have a story of how it all happened, but I think there are different cultures in the United States that have different senses of what's valuable, and their cultural techne has them see and think that certain things matter and the other side that other things matter, and they can't interpret each other because they don't share a cultural techne where there's a shared set of meanings, and they're trying to get around the other's meanings and manipulate the meanings. And so I think that this is always a risk because we have many little cultures, right? And the cultures of the academy are really alien to a lot of people in the United States. And they came to symbolize sort of elite telling me what to do, anti-liberty sort of stuff. And that kind of went, whoops, you know, because that's not quite how we see ourselves, but that's how they see us. And so we don't rely on the same information sources, we don't rely on the same values, et cetera, and that kind of shift. But it's not a complete answer, but is it something of an answer?
Okay, so can we just thank our speaker for...